Hello, and welcome to the first Locust Roundtable podcast of 2012. With me today are Siobhan Carroll, who is an academic and teacher at the University of Delaware. She writes fiction under her own name and also as Von Carr. Siobhan, could you say hello?
Hi, Karen, and hi, Austin. It's really nice to be here.
And also with us is Austin Serkin, who is doing graduate work at Georgia State University and is a rather well-known specialist in the steampunk field. Austin?
Yes, that is all true. Thank you.
And one thing that I wanted to talk to you both today about is the idea of being an academic who specializes in the fantastic literature, things like fantasy, science fiction, and steampunk. I've met you both at the International Conference for the Fantastic and the Arts, which it sounds like we will all be at again this coming March.
And looking forward to it.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful excuse to be in Florida in March.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about how you came to the conference, how it works in with your academic studies, and then also with your more conventional reading and writing of science fiction. Siobhan, why don't you start?
Sure thing. Well, I first heard about ICFA, as I know it to be called, via some friends at Indiana University when I was doing my PhD, and they recommended it very highly, said it was a wonderful conference, and I really ought to check it out. So I did, and I was persuaded. What was the second part of your question again, Karen?
Oh, sort of how it... how your academic work with the fantastic has at all changed how you write or how you read the fiction of the field.
Oh boy.
Starting out with the easy questions.
That's right.
Just tossed you off into the deep end here, you know.
Yeah, I'm going to plunge down into the bottom of this swimming pool, or steampunk aquarium, if possible first. That's actually a really interesting question. I would say to some extent, if you end up as an academic, you probably always had leanings in that direction. So in other words, I think I may have always read science fiction and fantasy a little bit like a wannabe academic. I mean, I remember reading Watership Down in something like the sixth grade and eagerly looking up all the quotations I could find that had the chapters and then trying to figure out how they influenced Adam's story, because I could see that there was something going on in this text that was more than just the plot, and I wanted to get at that, and I wanted to understand what was happening. I would say that my training in academia has really expanded my skill set in that area and has taught me a great deal about the history of literature and of science fiction and fantasy, and that has then fed into my own fiction, which sometimes, God help me, is hopelessly literary, as in the case of this Jane Eyre story I have out right now, which has yet to find a happy home. And regarding the way I read texts, I wouldn't say it's changed the enjoyment that I take in reading science fiction and fantasy, but it has actually sort of given me more pleasure in reading the text, because I now can read a book and I look for at least five different strands of interest, if you will, instead of just one or two, which I think is how I used to read books and short stories. Austin, what about you?
All right, well, interestingly enough, I suppose I should mention that Siobhan and I have known each other for several years, actually more than several, quite a few years at this point. And we met originally at ICFA. And it was not just the two of us. There were actually a number of people who all went for their first time the same year. And we all sort of became friends. I don't know. Do you have any idea how many of us there were that year, Siobhan?
Oh, God. We formed our own little army, it feels like.
Yeah, it sure does.
We had a lot of people out there from Indiana, some of whom I'm hoping will be at ICFA again. Darja Malcolm Clark.
I haven't seen her in years.
Yeah, hopefully she'll be able to come out.
Well, yeah. Gina has a paper on the schedule, so I hope she'll be there.
Well, in that case, she better be making that flight. She's in Estonia right now. David Higgins, of course, who's been organizing the SF section. And I know I'm a list. There are so many names I could bring up, but yeah, we had a good gang that year, and I think that people have a similar experience every year. If they are a newcomer, it's a great conference to meet people at. And if you keep going over the years, you start to build up a really nice collection of wonderful people, like you, Austin, whom you know and who are eccentric and strange and interesting and lovely people. So,
I remember one time walking into the lobby at ICFA and immediately, you know, I hadn't even checked into the hotel and ran into some people having an interesting conversation. And somebody else wandered up and joined and then was like, you know, it's like a family reunion every year, except it's full of only the family you like.
Well, you know, actually, ICFA had a pretty big impact on my life in that respect. You know, when I went for the first time, I was not a graduate student. I was still an undergraduate student at that point. And part of the reason that I went is because I am from Miami originally, and I was going to the University of Miami at the time. And someone there, I cannot remember who, knew about ICFA and recommended it to me. And I cannot for the life of me remember who. I wish I could, but I can't. But I looked it up, and I went, you know, just, I didn't have a paper to present. I just went. And I met so many amazing people and had so many amazing conversations that it basically, I mean, that one weekend essentially convinced me to go into graduate school, specifically in literature, just because, you know, I just wanted to be a part of all of that, you know, and now I am, and that's been great.
Yeah, and I have to say, just to tag on to the end of that comment, Austin, that I think that's one of the great advantages of ICFA. I think it sort of has this unique quality because it has both the writer and the academic tracks, that it's this wonderful place where academia, on one hand, speaks to a wider audience than it might normally, because people who are not graduate students, who are not English professors or film studies professors, attend this particular conference and get to listen to papers and participate in academic life for the first time for many of them. And at the same time, you also have the writers coming in from the outside to keep us English literary types honest, if you will, by standing up in the middle of our papers and saying, that's not what I said, or that's a myth I have yet to hear it confirmed.
Yeah. Though, but, I've had a lengthy conversation with Stephen Erickson, and he very much encourages people to come present on his books, and he just is so intensely curious about what people will read into his writing. Yeah. And I think that's a very healthy attitude to have, and I think that's great.
Actually, I think almost worse than the authors who would stand up, and again, you're right, it's totally mythical. I've never seen an author do that. But the ones that are worse is when the author plants himself in the front row and just spends the entire time staring at you bemusedly.
Yeah.
With no reaction one way or the other. And you're like, yeah, what am I... Oh, God.
Yeah. But I think, and this is now me putting on my writer hat, I think there are few things so wonderful as an author than to hear or to read a review or to hear a paper given by someone who's really obviously taken the time to read your work with great care and has perhaps, who knows, put even more thought into it than you have. I mean, we all love reviewers who give us good reviews, but to get that level of intense scrutiny of one's work and to have someone who's also in the doing something creative with your work, but in a slightly different way, you know, coming up with a new way to read your particular novel or your particular story, I just think that's fabulous. And, you know, it's one of the great pleasures of ICFA. I would advertise to all the writers out there.
Yeah, no. I think that's absolutely the case.
Now, so one thing I was saying is that people listening may not be entirely familiar with sort of what goes on in academic work on popular culture. I think it's a little less well known than some of your traditional, you know, people who read do Shakespeare scholarship or, you know, papers that are perhaps more into the sciences. People are kind of familiar with how that might work. But could you each give an example of papers that you've given it, or a paper that you've given at ICFA in the past, and what approach you took? Maybe Austin?
Sure. Last year, the paper that I gave was on steampunk, which is, you know, sort of my thing, I guess, at least for now. And it was specifically about evaluating steampunk props as examples of material folk culture. So essentially, I guess what I'm saying is that, to sort of break that down into an easily digestible soundbite, essentially what I was looking at was the folk skills that go into making steampunk props, and how those may be an expression of skills that in a past time may have gone toward more traditionally understood folk things, like, you know, pottery or making a banjo or something. I don't know, whatever you want to think of as folk. The truth of the matter is that folk skills cover a much wider variety than most people think. And so especially with the theme of repurposing, steampunk really fits in very well with that. So I thought that was interesting, at least.
Yeah, no, I remember that paper. That was an intriguing way to look at steampunk, Austin. Have you done anything with it since?
I have intended to do something with it since. Does that count?
And thus speaks the graduate student. No, it's true. An example of a paper that I gave a couple of years ago, I gave a paper on American gods, and I was looking at American gods through the lens of some geographical theory and theories of nationhood. I'm actually going to sort of pause here just for a second and explain that I'm actually a specialist in 18th and 19th century British literature, so I tend to approach a lot of texts from a historical background. And my science fiction and fantasy scholarship is spun off from those interests. So I do a lot of work with, for example, the history of exploration and the height of the British Empire. And therefore, I'm interested in how people get to think of themselves as American, for example, in relation to the landscape that they inhabit. That's not something that's natural. That's something that's being created by our culture. And I was interested to see how it worked in Neil Gaiman's American Gods. So basically in it, I argue that Neil Gaiman is a genius and that this book is doing some really interesting things with how urban fantasies have previously been imagining space. And it's actually rewriting and challenging some of the ways that American or Canadian space was represented in the works of Charles de Lint, for example. And that has been turned into an article that's going to be forthcoming from Extrapolation later this year. So if you're interested in reading more and want to see what this kind of scholarship might look like, you are welcome to do that. And don't be scared off by me quoting Sarah Palin at the beginning.
Okay, that's different.
Never mind.
And it all ties together in a grand bow of science fiction scholarship. Fantasy scholarship. There we go.
Yeah, I notice it's easier in the context of ICFA. I tend to initially say, you know, science fiction scholarship or science fiction this, and I think that's just my background coming to the field, but I think the fantastic seems to encompass it a little better.
Yeah, although I have some issues with the fantastic as a category, mainly because that phrase means something else in a lot of the scholarship. It actually doesn't refer to science fiction or fantasy at all. It refers to things like the first season of Lost, where you're not sure if what you're watching is in one genre or another. Maybe you're watching something that's completely realistic. Maybe you're watching science fiction, but you're not sure.
I like how you said just the first season of Lost, because personally speaking, even at the very end in the last season, I still didn't really know.
Well, I was going to just sort of give up because I'm not even sure the writers knew what was going on.
Yeah.
By that time. I'll stick with the parts where I was sure it was deliberate.
Okay, you do that. Whatever helps you sleep at night.
Well, thank you, Austin. The other part of your comment, though, Karen, that I was going to tag onto there was that actually science fiction scholarship itself is far more prevalent and respected in academia than fantasy scholarship. That's something that's only started to come in recently and gain some traction with a resurgence of interest in things like Tolkien studies, for example, in the wake of the Lord of the Rings movies, and Harry Potter and children's literature. But as I've discovered, as someone who, you know, primarily reads fantasy and wants to work on fantasy, it can be hard to find journals that would be interested in that kind of scholarship. So I think that of the two, fantasy is still the more marginal subject to be worked on in academia, which I happen to think makes it exciting.
Well, to be fair, I mean, when you look at the history of science fiction and fantasy, science fiction, you know, developed earlier, essentially,
yeah.
as you know, what we would consider modern science fiction versus modern fantasy.
Okay, then once you put that caveat on there, I'll go with that. I was going to quibble, but okay.
No. I mean, you know, we sort of like to think of things in their modern form, but I mean, really. You know, science fiction and fantasy in their pre-modern form or protean form or whatever, you know, word you want to use.
Bloopy form?
Right. have really been around, you know, for thousands of years or whatever, you know. So, you know, but it's easier to draw a direct link from the past to the present if you, you know, go back to, you know, say, Frankenstein for science fiction and, you know, Tolkien for fantasy.
Mm. Yeah, I was just thinking that there was this really fascinating period from like 1880, I want to say 1920, where if you picked up a genre magazine or if you read something that called itself fantasy, it was what we would now call weird fiction.
Yeah.
Weird fiction actually seems, and of course there's this resurgence now with a couple of excellent anthologies that just came out this year, and Anne Vandermeer's tenure at Weird Tales. That seems to have had an interesting continuity, totally separate from what we now think of as science fiction and what we now think of as fantasy.
Yeah. I think that one of the things we're wrestling with as critics is that so much of this field has been defined by publishers, though, to be honest. Mm. I mean, what we're talking about here, when you're talking about weird fiction, Karen, to some extent, we think of weird fiction, we think of Weird Tales, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And what Austin was talking about with the sort of invention of fantasy, David Hartwell's got a great article out on the invention of fantasy as a publishing category, which I think makes it clear that, you know, to some extent, the publishers and the venues of publication have been the ones setting the labels for a long time, so that when we as critics come back and try and define our own genealogies of the type of thing we are looking at, it can be hard. It can be hard to negotiate these kinds of categories when you want to talk about the history of a particular thing that has only been published or that has been published in and outside of these categories. Whereas, to give you a different example that will hopefully make it clear what I'm talking about, when you're looking at things like romantic literature, for example, the Lake poets weren't publishing their work and calling it romantic literature. They weren't saying, you know, we are publishing under this particular label and they weren't being distributed by people who were giving it a particular tag that then became the same tag that was adopted by the people who were doing the academic's job of criticizing it, or, you know, exploring what it meant and what they were trying to talk about. A lot of the sort of organizational work was being done by reviewers, which is a little bit different, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, even further than that, there's sort of the perennial debate as to what exactly science fiction and fantasy are.
Ah, run away! Run away!
Yeah. Oh, here we go.
And so it sort of helps if we just kind of do away with that dichotomy altogether. Mm-hmm. And sort of finally admit to ourselves that they don't really mean anything.
Oh, gosh.
Well, I know, Austin, of course, you've been specializing in steampunk for a few years, and that's, you know, that's sort of been a phenomenon that's been defining itself over the last few years as well. I mean, that's been sort of a self-organizing category.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've attempted to, several times, actually, to figure out whether steampunk is science fiction or fantasy, and have been completely unable to do so. Because every time I think that it might be science fiction, I think of an example of it being fantasy. And every time I think of it as being fantasy, I find examples of it being science fiction. So I feel like steampunk sort of is a microcosm for the greater science fiction fantasy debate. But I mean, I guess to be a little bit more specific, because people may or may not be interested in this, you know, it's easy to think of science fiction as, you know, being about technology, and mm-hmm. and steampunk is absolutely about technology. In fact, you know, that's why we're essentially not just you know, reenactors, is that it's about the technology, about man's interaction with technology. And so, you know, on the surface, you look at that and you're like, oh, well, this is clearly science fiction. But at the same time, it's not exactly, because what we have a lot of times is very escapist in nature and is dealing with technology that is not new and is not extrapolated from our modern technology, but instead sort of extrapolated forward from a past time to create this strange amalgamation that, you know, never was, as people like to say. And so that sort of escapist, you know, not grappling with the problems of technology aspect is kind of, you know, more in the realm of fantasy. But then you have other works like, well, I don't want to spoil The Prestige for anybody who has not read it or seen it at this point, but then you have stories like The Prestige where it does deal with some of those issues that are very much, you know, modern concerns with science. So, you know, what do you end up saying? Yeah, I mean... You know, if you have steampunk, where is it going to be, you know, shelved in the bookstore, under science fiction or fantasy? Or far more likely, it'll be under the science fiction and fantasy section. But
you see, there we're still being a little bit enthralled to the dynamic of publishers and bookstores, those that remain. Because even in your phrasing, Austin, you know, we notice that we're trying to phrase this dichotomy as one of where do you shelve it in the bookstore? Well, that's not necessarily a problem for those of us who buy books and have them in our home library. That's a problem for the people selling the books. You know, what label do they stick on the back cover? And what does that mean in terms of how they market it? Yeah. I was really interested, Austin, you had a paper, I think, a few years ago in which you were talking about steampunk, looking at steampunk just as a set of aesthetics. Do you remember that? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I found that very persuasive.
Yeah, I mean, essentially the idea is that steampunk, I mean, you know, steampunk is not a genre. When you look at you know, science fiction and fantasy, which, you know, and I know we're talking about breaking down the barriers between that, but just, you know, for the moment, let's look at them as distinct categories. You know, when you look at science fiction and fantasy, there are distinct characteristics that set those apart from, you know, just regular, you know, modern day fiction, for example.
Regular realist fiction, perhaps.
Right, realist fiction. There we go. But if you look at steampunk, story-wise, there's not really anything in there to set it apart from either science fiction or fantasy or mystery or romance or any of the categories that we already have. The only thing that steampunk really brings to the table is an aesthetic. You know, it's helpful for me to look at steampunk as just that setting and aesthetic rather than as a genre.
And yeah, I think that makes sense based on a lot of the text that I've seen out there that wear their steampunk goggles proudly.
Indeed. And well, you know, and as everybody knows, you can't have steampunk without goggles.
Oh, absolutely.
Exactly. And air pirates.
I see goggles on a book cover, I think to myself, oh, this must be steampunk.
Exactly.
Actually, but at the same time, we run the risk of sticking gears on things, right? Isn't there some kind of damning regretsy phrase that can also be applied to literature? Just because you stick goggles on it does not turn, you know, Lovecraft into a steampunk writer.
Somebody made a song on YouTube, and I wish I could give the proper attribution for this, but it was called Just Glue Some Gears on It and Call It Steampunk. And it was rather a tongue-in-cheek look at the practice of gluing gears on things and calling it steampunk.
So my specialty over the last year or so, which everybody who's listened to this podcast will be absolutely tired of me mentioning every time I get an excuse, I've been working on Greg Egan for the longest time. His most recent book that was published was titled Clockwork Rocket, and you know they chose the word clockwork to try and get another look in from people who, you know, might otherwise dismiss a hard SF title from Egan, going, could it be steampunk? Well, no, it's not steampunk, it's Egan.
Well, what I find very interesting, actually, is how often clockwork becomes interchangeable with steampunk, while clockwork stuff is actually from an entirely different era.
Right, it's much, much older.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so really the whole concept of steam power and, you know, all of this was such a different driving force than clockwork things, you know, socially and culturally and whatever of the time. But yet we still think of clockwork as being steampunk. And, you know, of course they had clockwork things at the time, but, you know, I mean, the amount of effort that went into making a piece of clockwork machinery at the time was immense. So, you know, steam was much easier in that respect.
Yeah. I think from the point of view of literature, clearly the reason people want to lump clockwork and in with steampunk is because it features an archaic technology. The aesthetics of archaic technology are, according to you, Austin, what people associate with this particular subgenre. I find it very intriguing, though, that remark about just the anger, though, that's directed at... I've seen it more, again, with crafts as opposed to literature, but perhaps, who knows, Karen, perhaps there might be a backlash against the Egan title from people who are disappointed that it doesn't fulfill their steampunk fantasies.
I think the back cover blurb, if anybody stops, gets past the one word on the title and reads the back cover blurb, that should cure them.
I'm curious, therefore, about the literature, and this is a question more for you to answer, Austin, but are there things that have gears on them that steampunk readers will not see as steampunk? It is rejected out of hand.
Well,
it is not punk enough.
Well, Justin Bieber aside.
Oh God, help us all.
Well, actually, I should probably explain that because the listeners of this podcast may certainly not be familiar with Justin Bieber in any real sense. But this past Christmas season, Justin Bieber came out with a steampunk music video.
Wasn't it For Santa Claus Is Coming to Town or something?
It was indeed For Santa Claus Is Coming to Town. It made no sense whatsoever. I have no idea why they chose to couple Santa Claus Is Coming to Town with Justin Bieber with steampunk.
However, I think we should just have a moment of silence while our listeners contemplate the apocalypse.
Well, and perhaps stuff their brains back in their ears.
All right.
However, that said, everybody in the video looked very good, and the styling was very good, except for Bieber himself. But I know how these things work behind the scenes, and I know that he had his own, you know, fashion consultant or whatever. And I also actually know the people who did the video, who did the steampunk aspects of the video, and they're very good. But somebody had to sit there and make the decision that they wanted steampunk in a Bieber video for Santa Claus Is Coming to Town. So I don't know who's on the hook for that one, but anyway, so it's funny that you mentioned that, Siobhan, because I was just thinking to myself, actually, that, you know, going back to what we were saying about science fiction and fantasy, you know, while yes, the publishers have largely imposed that on us, at the same time, we need some sort of metric by which to you know, allow people to choose what sort of thing they want to read.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's exactly that question of expectations that you were mentioning. Or maybe it was Karen that was mentioning, I forget. But, you know, when you pick up a book, you go into it with a certain amount of expectations. And whether you like or dislike the book will largely be a question of how it, you know, accommodates your expectations. And so, you know, steampunk in that respect kind of has difficulty because it's such a broad, you know, sort of thing. You can pick up a steampunk book and be like, okay, well, this book is about steampunk. And that doesn't really mean anything. You know, you don't know whether you're in for, you know, a primarily, you know, science fiction-y kind of story or a fantasy-ish kind of story or, you know, a romance or a mystery or what have you, you know? So I'm sure, to answer your question, I'm sure there are people who pick up steampunk books and do not like them, you know, because it does not fulfill some sort of need that they have or some expectation. And that is difficult. And I don't really know what to do about that.
It is, and it's interesting when people almost latch on to the aesthetics of something. That's what readers and consumers of art do, right? When we go, when we're kids, oh, I want to read another book that has dragons in it. Perhaps as a teenager, we go, I want to read another book that has vampires in it. And perhaps as a moviegoer, you go, I want to go and see another movie that has cars and people fighting in it, and then you end up going to see Drive, and it's not the Fast and the Furious, and you're angry about this. You know, that's how consumers approach things. We like this thing. Here, we are going to take this arbitrary aesthetic element as an organizing principle, and we're going to try and chase this thing, and publishers and movie makers are desperately going to try and fulfill that need. And what's going to happen inevitably is that, A, there's going to be a spawn of Fast and the Furious clones that will satisfy those of us who are looking for Vin Diesel and cars, and on the other hand, we're also going to end up wandering into some narratives and when works that have nothing to do with the kinds of things that we wanted and like. They just happen to have a dragon, vampire, exploding car in it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, what do we do about that? I mean, in a lot of cases, that can unintentionally be a good thing because it can push people outside of their comfort zones, so to speak. But, you know, some people don't need that, don't want that, etc. So,
well, this kind of hits on an interesting point because, you know, you've got readers, you've got reviewers, and then you have critics and academics.
That's right.
And then there's this whole spectrum of how you can be approaching things. My instinct as a reviewer myself is to say, well, reviewers can help step in and bridge that gap and be the ones to help set the expectations. to fill the gap that might say, you know, if you're looking for more sparkly vampires, then perhaps Interview with a Vampire isn't where you go next from Twilight. But then again, you know, some people dispute whether or not Revere should fill that role. And then, of course, academics are really kind of doing something different.
Yeah, I was going to say, academics, our job is to do precisely the kinds of let's follow the vampire's trope and see where it gets us. Let's put Fast and the Furious up against Drive and see what Drive is doing that is going to horrify some viewers, but is doing with this kinds of automobile machismo that other car movies celebrate. What does it mean that this object, when you put this object up against things that superficially look like it? What happens when we put Twilight up against Dracula or Buffy? What happens when we take your object of choice and put it together and try and figure out what does it say about our culture? What does it say about the strange imagination that sort of is as a whole producing these works of art? And what does it mean to us?
You know, it occurs to me that this is also the problem that we had a couple years ago when anime started getting really popular.
That's right.
Specifically Pokemon. Because, you know, you had all these parents whose kids watch Pokemon and, you know, thought it was fine, whatever, it's cartoons. And then you have them, you know, finding La Blue Girl or something, and, you know, then it all goes to hell. So it does in some way behoove us to find a working system that allows us to, you know, manage people's expectations of what they will or will not get out of something. And frankly, I think that is sort of going to fix itself as time goes on, because we're moving toward this sort of, you know, ebook reader kind of future. And when you're browsing for books on the internet, it's a lot easier to read reviews or read, you know, critics or whatever, what have you, and learn a little bit more about the book before you buy it, as opposed to, you know, wandering the shelves at a bookstore, you know, trying to pick out a book, and you're like, oh, I like the cover of this book, I will get it, you know, at which point you're of course much more likely to be surprised by the contents.
Yeah, I don't know. In my experience, readers do whatever the hell they want to do.
Don't we all?
Yeah, I think the life of, gosh, no, God knows, many publishers would be much easier if people would, you know, just fall in love with covers. And I think the lives of many authors and movie houses would be much easier if people would just please read the reviews before they took up this book, watched this video, took their kids to see Princess Mononoke, as the case might be. readers are always going to do their own thing, and people are going to approach works in their own way, and that's fine, and that's great. I would actually rather that than to have people completely enslaved to one cultural critique that tells them, whether it's, you know, how run by academics, reviewers, authors, or publishing houses, that tells them what they ought to see and read.
Well, there was actually a really interesting panel at ICFA this past year, to bring us back to ICFA, and I can't remember who all was on it, but it was a panel of people who were writers, who worked in the industry, and they were talking about the repeatable experience. And
ooh,
how
yes.
important that was or was not to, you know, the genre or the, you know, the entire field, I guess. And I don't know, Siobhan, what do you think? How does the repeatable experience fall into what it is that we're talking about here?
Well, I think you've nailed it. I mean, when the breeder who goes and looks for the next sparkly vampire or the next dragon is looking for that object that will make them feel the same way that original object did. And hey, isn't to some extent that how we all read and how we all consume our media? You know, I really like The Wire, and I want something that will make me feel the way I felt when I was watching The Wire. And I think some of us who end up reading a lot and watching a lot get to this point where we realize suddenly that it didn't depend on the objects. It was about a really good story being told in a certain way. But we're all in search of repeatable experiences. I want to read a book that grips me as much as The Hunger Games did last year. You know, I just don't know that it's going to be a dystopian novel featuring a girl who is pursued by boys she's not sure about.
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty fair. Though, I mean, what to do about that, I don't really know.
Well, it's not really a problem to be solved. It's a reality to be contemplated. There we go.
Well, let's have a moment of silence to contemplate it.
Oh, dear, but now visions of Justin Bieber are rearing themselves in my head. Can't have that.
No, no. I would, in fact, have a great deal of sympathy for you if you were plagued by visions of Justin Bieber anytime you were silent.
Well, and thank goodness are the experiences which we want to repeat evolve over time so that, you know, the crushes I had as a 12-year-old are they're not experiences I want to repeat in my 30s.
What? I find that hard to believe. No, and it's so interesting, and to take this back again to steampunk, as I'm sure will happen a number of times, you know, that's what's so interesting about alternate history becoming so popular right now, because, you know, we all grow up, we have experiences that, you know, we probably don't want to have again, though we also have experiences that we do want to have again. But now we have this sort of intense popularity of the past, but it's, you know, it's not even really about the past. It's sort of about what we think the past was like, and I could go on about that at length. But you know,
can you give me an example of something that's not steampunk, Austin, that would do the kind of work you're talking about there?
Did you have something specific in mind?
I was curious about what you had in mind. I mean, I'm thinking right now of The Artist, but I'm the movie, the silent movie that's absolutely fabulous that you guys should all see.
I have not seen it.
You should. It's wonderful. You'll like it. Don't watch any trailers beforehand. But this sort of nostalgia or this interest in rehashing history but doing it in a different way.
Sure. I mean, there's a vast quantity of examples of alternate history that are not steampunk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you look at Harry Turtledove's work. You know, his stuff is not. If you don't know, you know, his collection, he does a lot of work with like World War II and, you know, alternate history where, you know, the things didn't work out differently, or things worked out differently, and so it's all about how the world ended up. And, you know, there's stuff where, like, I think I remember there was a book where there were like dragons in World War II or something.
Oh, yeah,
like
my
that.
My husband really enjoyed those.
Yeah, huh. See? So,
although
I mean,
think his breakout work was Civil War related.
Oh, yeah, Civil War, that's right. So anyway, Guns of the South, there we
go.
And so anyway, and that's not really steampunk at all. That's pretty purely just alternate history. So, you know, the steam aspect is not required for that sort of thing. But, you know, what we have right now is a fascination with technology. Or I guess, let's not say fascination, let's say preoccupation. You know, the fact of it is that technology has integrated itself into our lives in a way that is unprecedented throughout the course of human history. You know, a lot of people like to say that, oh, you know, we've been down this road before. You know, people always, you know, over exaggerate about technology and, you know, blah, 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 etc. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that we are exploring new territory, and, you know, with that comes a certain amount of cultural anxiety, I suppose, where people are concerned about where it's all going and et cetera. I mean, you know, and this is exactly the sort of, you know, stuff that you saw back in the Victorian era. And
yeah.
In fact, the Time Machine was sort of a reaction to a lot of that, which was interesting. But so, you know, you see a lot of similar themes today, you know, in a lot of our writing and science fiction as there was in the Victorian era.
Yeah. That's my I'm thinking through what you just said, Austin. I think even your comment that this is similar to the Victorian era, you're sort of saying that this to some extent isn't a unique moment in history, although of course to every generation I suppose feels that their moment in history is unique. I suspect that if we'd been living in, you know, an era where we just learned that if you bang rocks together, you could get fire, that we too would have felt that our entire world had been transformed by a new technology. And we would have probably, our stories would probably have changed to reflect that.
There was a movie that I saw this year that it almost exactly hit the note.
This year.
Oh, sorry, 2011, this past year. Midnight in Paris, the Woody Allen film, is exactly about that nostalgia, but without hitting the steampunk note.
That's right.
It's exactly hitting that yearning for the golden age.
Yeah,
no,
and actually,
which
if I think
golden
about
age that is that you are yearning for.
Yeah, if I think about a lot of other, here are some non steampunk examples I can think of. Stephen King's new novel, you know, the JFK assassination book, that's an alternate history for you. But then along the Midnight in Paris lines, I mentioned The Artist earlier, but we can also think of Mad Men, Boardwalk Empire, these sort of, even Downton Abbey perhaps, these works that are all considering, suppose, I wouldn't call Boardwalk Empire a golden age moment, but that are looking back with a very particular, somewhat nostalgic lens at an era, but are emphasizing different parts of it. Obviously, there's a reason we like these things, that we're interested in them right now.
Yeah, well, it's about more than technology. You know, technology is a big part of it, but for example, I read an article in, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, in the New York Times, in which it was written by a woman of some variety, and she was essentially saying that women don't really know what to do with themselves these days, because
oh, really?
You know. Well, this is what she was saying. I, you know, whether you buy into it or not, I don't know what to tell you, but you know, a lot of women don't really know what to do with themselves because there's no longer an expectation for their behavior, for their, you know, lifestyle. You know, there's no longer this, you know, women are supposed to behave a certain way, men are supposed to behave a certain way. You know, there's no guidelines for life anymore, essentially.
So the crisis of masculinity has moved back to women.
Apparently, right. Or at least so this woman was saying. Now, whether you buy that or not, you know, it doesn't really matter. But the fact that somebody was even saying that, I think, is indicative of the fact that some people do feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and so I think that contributes to this, you know, sort of fascination with a time when gender roles, among other things, were much more concrete.
Yeah. Well, as I think about it, actually, though, a lot of these stories, and I'm thinking of Mad Men, where I'm at least caught up, and what I've seen of Boardwalk Empire and so on.
Mad Men is
the artist.
True.
A lot of these stories are actually about people adapting to the fact that their gender roles and et cetera are out of step with the times. I actually don't know that these are about looking back at the past and seeing with a nostalgic perspective how simpler things were then, because I think particularly with a lot of these shows that are following people as they desperately struggle to adapt to the times, they are emphasizing instead a kind of continuity between these previous eras and ourselves, where we know in these shows the directions that history is going to go, but the characters don't, and they are making decisions based on the information they have, and sometimes doing some really stupid things in a desperate attempt to carve their own way through a world that's actually much less certain than our nostalgia goggles might have us believe. So I think if this sort of move towards the past outside of steampunk is reflecting something in our culture, it's a sort of an optimism that we too will get through this because it has happened before.
Yeah, I think that is probably right on the money. You see this a lot actually in steampunk with gender and race, and I run panels at fan conventions. What we see a lot of times is the way that gender and race are dealt with in steampunk is very empowering, and you have, you know, female characters who, you know, shed their skirts, so to speak, in favor of pants, and you have, you know, black people, Asian people, etc., who are, you know, having power and agency and you know, the ability to take control of their lives, which is great. And in these panels that I run, it's come up a lot that people of color feel that these stories are very empowering, and that that era was a time that did not really belong to them in terms of power dynamics, and that you know, in these sort of you know, films and novels, etc., they can sort of you know, retroactively take power back for themselves and sort of come to terms with that era, you know, in their own way. And I think that's very interesting and fascinating and great, really.
So it's kind of a reclaiming of, or a claiming of, imperial adventure literature in a way. You know, you too can imagine yourself or see representatives of a person like you having the kind of swashbuckling adventures previously reserved for some white Englishman with a great big mustache.
that is exactly right. Though the great big mustache is optional.
Well, not in
my case, though.
Well, and that makes sense, because it seems like, you know, the common thread is that some of these works aren't looking back at the past just through the rose-colored glasses of nostalgia, but they're looking back at the past with a critical eye.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've, you know, any time I talk about steampunk, what you really have to say is sort of a disclaimer that, you know, everyone who comes to steampunk comes for, you know, a slightly different reason, or at the very least for a wide variety of reasons. And so you can't really just, you know, put everybody together and say, well, everyone is interested in steampunk because of, you know, blank.
You mean we can't generalize about people, Austin?
Sure you can. That's what economics is about.
Wow, thank God.
Thank God we still have that.
Yep. At least we can just generically lump people together and tar them all with the same brush. That's what I live for.
Alternately, that's what psychohistory is about.
There you go.
Oh, true, true.
I'd be curious, actually, about turning this in a slightly different direction. We've talked about steampunk and about nostalgia for history, but sure. We've recently seen a great resurgence in interest, particularly in YA lit, in the dystopian future.
Oh, yeah.
So what do we make of that? Do you have any thoughts on that, Austin?
Well, that's, I think that's part of a much broader issue as well. And, you know, this, I think, all ties in to modernism, postmodernism, and the perpetually argued post-postmodernism.
I'm at post-post-post-post, just so you know.
Ah, so you mean you're a hipster.
Oh. You've discovered my other secret.
So, anyway, you know, it's at the point where people have certain expectations. And, you know, again, this is connecting to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, managing expectations. We as an audience have built up, how do I say this exactly? We have developed entertainment absorption skills. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think I get where you're getting at.
Like we have developed certain skills that allow us to take in entertainment when it is expressed to us in a certain manner. Right?
So I can be entertained reading Facebook, whereas if I showed that to somebody from the 1500s, they'd probably call me a witch, but before that, they'd... you know, be very confused by all the cat videos. Is that what you're saying?
not exactly the direction that I was going in, but okay. I was specifically thinking of, like, storytelling and the way that we tell stories and the things that we have come to expect to be given in a story. You know, for example, there was a time in cinema where the good guy wore a white hat and the bad guy wore a black hat. You know, and there was an expectation that the good guy and the bad guy would be clearly identifiable. Right?
Yeah, so we're talking about people being trained in reading conventions. Might be a different way of expressing that.
Yes, there we go. That is exactly right. So I guess what I was saying is that so we've been trained by these things to have certain expectations of what a story will give us. And I feel like we're in a period where some semblance of realism or overrealism or something, I'm not exactly sure what it would be called, is vital to our buying or buying into a story.
Well, and I have to admit, I have a knee-jerk thought that the age group that is currently reading YA, none of them are probably able to remember a time before 9/11.
Yes.
So their
and that's very intriguing.
Their whole lives have been... Because things haven't really settled down since then, have they? There have been some economic ups and downs, there have been wars ups and downs... There hasn't been a real placid time for them to sort of find their footing and go, oh, well, this is what the world is. What they know the world as, the nightly news, has been very chaotic. And I wonder if that's, you know, if they tried to read YA from an older time period, they might say, well, that has nothing to do with the world I'm living in.
Perhaps. I mean, it's not as though YA has just found the dystopian future.
Obviously.
I mean, and I'll just have to do a shout-out here for Monica Hughes' Devil on My Back. You know, all of Monica Hughes' dystopias, I think, are... If people are looking for books like The Hunger Games, they should go and seek her works out, because they're fabulous. But building off what you're saying, Karen, because, I mean, the fact of the matter also is people in a particular cultural moment find certain things attractive. And we, you know, we're going through, or we've had... wars affecting our culture recently. There will be wars again. There have been wars in the past. And maybe we see similar responses during similar periods of history. But what's actually striking me as I'm thinking about these examples and thinking about our earlier conversation is that, to some extent, the dystopian novels are even more about gender roles and following rules than the nostalgia pieces of fiction we were mentioning earlier, in that, particularly in things like Hunger Games, and I just read Roth's Divergent, these are situations where a young teenage girl, or maybe a boy in some of the works I haven't read, is presented with what seems to be a very straightforward set of rules. You go in here, you fight 12 other people. If you live, hooray, and more likely you're going to die. Well, that at least is a very clear situation. You know, you've got a very you've got a contained problem, if you will. You're going to be in this arena. People are going to be trying to kill you. And there are strict rules to be followed. And basically, if you learn to play the game, and that includes a gender game, you will be okay. And of course, in the process of these YA novels, inevitably what the beleaguered teenager finds out is that actually the government is lying to you, and your parents have lied to you, and society has lied to you, because it's not that simple. You know, yes, you can learn to play the game by the rules that you have been given, but there are things moving behind the scenes that are going to make your success and your ability to succeed much more difficult. And in fact, sometimes the rules are going to be broken by the authorities that have given them to you.
Yeah,
and
so
I
it's
wonder,
just like real life.
Yeah, basically. And particularly I wonder if it's like real life in the post-George W. Bush era, to pick up on what Karen was, I think, suggesting. That maybe this is also a, let's go from 9/11. Here's a terrible crisis. You know, you as a young person are growing up in a world where at first there seem to be very clear rules of us and them, and this is how, what you need to be. You know, you study hard, you're going to get a job. You know, you fulfill the following expectations, you will be safe and protected, and that's not what happens. And maybe that's betrayal, that sense of betrayal is what dystopian fiction is registering, but maybe not.
Well, sort of what I was saying earlier about, you know, expectations and realism, and et cetera, you know, we've come to expect a high degree of realism in our stories, or at least plausible realism or something like that. And so I think how that connects to this is that, you know, dystopianism is real to us. I don't think these days anyone would look at a utopia and think, yeah, sure, that makes sense. You know, they can't look at the world around them and imagine that it is going to work out all right. You know, because we have, you know, awful news on the television all day, and, you know, et cetera. And so I see that reflected in our fiction. And I think you're absolutely right about the Hunger Games expressing sort of a post 9/11 worldview. And yeah, so there you go.
To pick up on that, I just finished reading, is it Bellamy's Looking Backwards recently?
Yeah.
So there's a classic American utopian novel for you, which spawned, when people read it, they loved it so much, it spawned, what was it again, is it the National Party? It actually spawned its own political movement of people who had read this book, and they thought it was awesome sauce. And they
were like libertarians.
So we're going to start building this utopia right now. Whereas I contrast that with, I can't actually think of a work that's utopian that's come out in recent memory, actually.
They definitely fell out of fashion after World War II.
I guess that old World War thing may have, you know, put a crimp in some people's style. But I'm also thinking of things like Ready Player One, actually, which ends, I'm going to do a very minor spoiler perhaps, which sort of ends happily for the individual, but also leaves the question of how is society going to be built from this point, pointedly, sort of unresolved. There's a sense, and the same goes for, again, Hunger Games and all these other dystopian works, at least the ones I can think of. In that the individual is reassured that he, she will turn out, will be just fine. You'll make it eventually. But what's going to happen to larger society? You've got to build it, but who knows if you're going to succeed? I wouldn't call that cynicism. I would call it a kind of very cautious realism, if anything.
Makes sense.
Yeah, sure. I'd get on board with that. But yeah, no, I mean, I can, you know, and I guess to sort of bring it back again to what I was saying earlier with modernism, postmodernism, and postpostmodernism, you know, World War II sort of is generally considered the, you know, the dividing line between modernism and postmodernism. And I feel like in a lot of ways, people who are growing up in a post 9/11 world kind of are moving toward either post-postmodernism or, you know, some new iteration of postmodernism. I had a conversation with a young man a while ago, and he was just starting college, and he basically was convinced that postmodernism did not exist. And that it was just a, you know, a further
it's
example.
It's a very postmodern perspective.
I know.
It's and so I could... meta, it just hurts.
And he was convinced that like modernism was like the thing. And I tried to explain to him how this was not the case. And it, I mean, the whole conversation was just so postmodernist that I wanted to scream. but I think, you know, I think we're reaching this point of almost oversaturation, where it's become a point where people can look at all of these things and just have them not make an impact anymore. You know, just because it's so pervasive everywhere. And as such, I think the pendulum is starting to swing back the other way.
Quite possible. Well, at that point, we should probably leave it there. I know, it's a bit of a cliffhanger, but...
we'll figure out everything, including post-postmodernism, at some future point.
Exactly.
Right. Same bat time, same bat channel.
But again, dear listener, that is an example of the sorts of conversations one can find at interesting conventions such as the International Conference for the Fantastic and the Arts. So definitely a plug for that conference where interesting thoughts are thought and interesting people can be engaged in conversation. Now, I did want to wrap up this Locust Roundtable podcast, as I have so many others, by giving you guys a chance to promote anything that you want to promote, any appearances you'll be making, or things you have out or published. Austin?
Well, I think the best thing for me to promote right now is our local alternate history convention. And I'm the culture track director for Anachrocon, it's called.
Cool.
It is a alternate history convention that is not specifically steampunk. It's for all alternate history. And I guess to get into this very briefly, I sort of run the track as a way to introduce academic concepts to the non-academic public. And it's really rewarding and a lot of fun, because I get to, you know, really go over a lot of, you know, interesting ideas and concepts to people who may never have been confronted with that sort of thing before. So it's really a lot of fun, and you know, we also have, you know, parties and stuff like that. So check that out. You can Google it, Anachrocon. I don't remember what the website is offhand. And alternately, in case you don't want to come down to Atlanta for that, we also do the alternate history track at DragonCon, which is a much bigger deal for those of us in the. In the fan convention scene, I suppose. So, yeah, come out and check those out.
Great, thank you. And Siobhan?
Well, of course, I'm going to be making an appearance at ICFA alongside Austin. I guess things to promote. Well, I mentioned that I've got an essay forthcoming earlier from Extrapolation. If you're interested in reading some of my fiction, including fiction that does horrible things to Twilight, you might be interested in my anti-Twilight story, Remains, which is out at AE, the Canadian Science Fiction Review online. I've also got stories available at Beneath Ceaseless Skies, if you Google them.
And if I'm not mistaken, I believe you've been showing up on some of the best of 2011 short fiction lists.
That's right. I've had a story from Beneath Ceaseless Skies called In the Gardens of the Night appeared there, as did The Strange Case of Madeline H. March, aged 14 and one quarter, which is my Lovecraft in the Basement story at the late and much loved Realms of Fantasy. So, and of course, if you're in the Delaware area, you can always take a class with me. I am teaching science fiction from the 1940s through now, next semester, actually, and I also teach fantasy courses.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. Well,
thank you very much for organizing this, Karen.
Yeah, and if you want to find us at ICFA, you should probably check out By the Pool.
Yes.
That's right.
By the Pool is the place to find everyone at ICFA.